It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Hi, I'm Robert Ovetz. I'm the editor of Workers Inquire and Global Class Struggle out on Pluto Press, and I'm a contingent academic lecturer.
Okay, my name is Gifford Hartman, and I work in adult education, and I've done a lot of different kinds of work. I've worked in public libraries and literacy. I've worked for unions. I've worked at worker centers. I've worked for nonprofits, and I continue to do that now, but I'm also consider myself a working class militant, and the reason I'm here today is because I follow class struggle, and that's what I'm into.
Awesome. Well, we want to welcome you both back. We've had both of you on over the years. It's great to have you on again. We're going to be talking about something that people are probably seeing in the news, is this idea that, you know, things are reopening. Supposedly, we're all going back to work. Restaurants are opening up again across the United States. And supposedly, there's this problem that capitalists are having where they're not finding enough workers to work the jobs that previously were open before. So we're going to be kind of picking that apart and talking about the different aspects to it. But just to get us kind of started off, you know, let's talk about the pandemic. Obviously, it's still unfolding, but what does it or did it mean for waged workers, just in terms of conditions, work? How did it fundamentally change things?
I'll go first. I would say it, you know, as we all know, it threw a lot of people out of work, and it, you know, it threw the whole economy into chaos. And if we compare it to what happened in the earlier crisis, the housing crash, in the housing crash, the GDP went down by 2.5%. That was in 2009. But in 2020, GDP in the U.S. went down 3.5%. So it was more severe than the previous crisis. And there's a lot of other things about it. If I could just contrast the world economy, places actually didn't do so badly, like China. China actually had 2.3 growth of their GDP because they were still producing stuff. But as we know, supply chains were frozen. Everybody remembers the toilet paper crisis and, you know, the hand sanitizer crisis, because the world economy had created a dispersed system of production where a lot of stuff was on these tenuous commodity chains, and they ran short at the beginning of the crisis. So I think that was one thing that was really immediate. I think we could kind of get into how workers resisted some of the imposition of hardship, but I think I'll just leave it there, that I think at the beginning we really saw the capitalist system stretched across the planet really couldn't provide for some of the things we desperately needed just in our everyday lives.
One of the greatest impacts of this catastrophic pandemic is that it really brought to central focus the importance of reproductive labor, that the workers that were most vulnerable to contracting and getting sick from and dying from the COVID virus were workers who were doing reproductive labor, nurses, food service workers, delivery workers, workers who had been dismissed as being part of service labor, who were considered unorganizable, who were contributing to a low productivity part of the labor force. These workers were taking the brunt of the pandemic, but they were also really at the forefront of responding to their dangerous working conditions, to their low pay, and to their exploitive working conditions that they found themselves in. And I think that, you know, the people who were going out every night at sunset and clapping and cheering. They were actually clapping and cheering for these workers who were essentially keeping the rest of us alive and at the same time suffering the brunt of the pandemic. And their response was pretty impressive. And, you know, we could get into that as well. But I think at the forefront, we really came to understand how important reproductive labor is to capitalism.
Yeah, and I think that kind of lies at the heart of what we'll be talking about is that how can we have this kind of like major contradiction where people have mentioned, especially workers, even people on this program, that like there's been this kind of new line driven between those that have the ability to kind of stay at home and work and those that have to kind of go out and risk themselves like among the wider population and continue to do the jobs, whether it's meat packing or going to pick up groceries for somebody. And then these are the jobs now that supposedly people aren't filling in the same numbers as before. So we've seen about 3 stimulus checks go out. This has been coupled with relief packages for unemployment. According to Republicans and others, these actions have made people lazy. What are we actually seeing?
Okay, I would just say that, you know, one factor is fear. And I think we can't dismiss that because I think, like Robert was saying, those kind of essential kinds of jobs in the caring industries, people are really in harm's way. And I think it makes a lot of sense that if you can get a $1,400 stimulus check, and remember early on, the unemployment supplements from the federal government were about $600 a week. I think now they're down to about, well, they've gone up and down and disappeared and come back now. They might be about $300 a week. Now, I can't speak for other people, but if it was me and I was working in one of those industries where I was subject to dangerous conditions or, you know, not safe provision of PPEs and stuff like that, I wouldn't work. And it makes a lot of sense to me that people are fearful and they don't see the bosses really caring about their health and safety. And I think that's one of the driving forces. And I think the Republicans are just flat out wrong. I think they just want to impose wage labor. And I think, you know, I think it's a very logical reaction.
I actually think that this is just a small part of the larger fiscal policy response that Republicans and Democrats have been pursuing since essentially last March and April. And I actually think that a lot of it, the first 2 COVID relief bills actually came from the Trump administration, and it was supported by a significant number of Republicans. And here's why. Payday Report, I think, was doing some great reporting in the early months of the pandemic. Up until this anti-racism strike, they had estimated around 800 wildcat strikes around the country. They didn't have a figure of how many workers were involved, but workers in all sectors of the labor force had been involved, from nurses to app drivers to teachers, bus drivers. And they had effectively disrupted a lot of the economy. Gifford, you were talking about how GDP declined by 3.5%. I think it has, no one's really looked into this, but I think those wildcat strikes probably contributed a significant portion of that decline in economic output. Workers were just unwilling to go along with showing up in dangerous, deadly working conditions. And the fiscal policy response, not just these 3 cash supplements, but also remember the additional benefits on unemployment, that ran out last fall and have now been extended at half the amount. Let's not forget paid family leave, paid sick leave. In many states, workers got additional paid sick leave, particularly public employees. And I think that this unprecedented fiscal policy response of government injecting huge amounts of money going directly into the pockets of workers was a response to try to dampen and tap down the self-organizing that was going on that was so disruptive.
The U.S. was very unusual in the world. Not a lot of other countries had a stimulus package as big as the one in the United States. In Europe, it was mostly just more austerity and more fiscal conservatism. So I think the U.S. was unique in that. And I think Robert's right. I think in some ways they were buying social peace by throwing out all this money to prevent resistance perhaps from rising even up, gaining strength.
Yeah, so this is a huge turn for the Republicans. And one thing that the Democrats really found themselves with their pants down is that the Republicans were playing a Democratic game of using fiscal policy. Of course, a big chunk of the COVID relief bills were tax cuts, but it really kind of started this wave now where the Biden administration's coming in and actually got Congress to pass another kind of stimulus that a lot of people really haven't been talking about the significance of, and it's a monthly payment to families with children. Now, it leaves out, of course, individuals and families without kids or kids older than 18, but it's a monthly supplement that's going to families essentially making about $100,000 or less. And that's a dramatic change in policy. And I think, Gifford, you're right. I think that this money was an attempt to try to buy labor peace. And unfortunately, the labor unions and the labor movement have really kind of missed the boat on this, that service workers have been so well, so effective at being self-organized that they were disruptive enough that you saw not just Democrats, but even Republicans come in and essentially supplement wages of tens of millions of workers and families. And so when now they're saying, oh, these workers, they don't want to take these jobs. I think, Gifford, you're right that part of it has to do with we don't want to go back to these unsafe conditions, but it's also these workers are essentially setting their pay rates now. What's extraordinary about this is that fiscal policy has essentially unofficially raised the minimum wage so that workers are now assessing, hey, do I want to put my life at risk for $15 an hour or even $20 an hour? No, I don't need to, because now we're getting this additional supplement to our income. And so I can pit employers against each other so that I get a better paying job that's in safer conditions. There's another aspect to this as well. And that is that I think of it as workers are essentially striking with their feet. They're essentially saying, look, if you don't give me the PPE, if you don't give me safe work conditions, I can go somewhere else and I can actually wait a few weeks or months because I can get this additional aid while I'm looking for a better job. So the tables have been turned. Workers now have an advantage in the labor market over employers. And that's pretty unusual for the last 40 years.
So do you feel like that's really kind of the answer to why these jobs are, quote, going unfilled? You know, obviously the Republicans have their fantasies they promoted about people being lazy. Other people have said, like, oh, people have had time to go back and get new skills. And now people are, like, working in Amazon fulfillment centers and stuff. They basically left the service industry and gone to other places in the economy, like leaving up these big gaps. But it sounds like you all are saying, no, it's people basically flexing their agency and having a little more control over their lives and, like, as you said, kind of striking with their feet.
Yeah, if I could just add one other thing to this, is that one of the things that employers don't like is are policies that make it easier for workers to change jobs. For example, the fact that we don't have a single healthcare system, a universal single-payer system, is an advantage to employers because now people hesitate and think twice or three times before they change jobs because they might lose their doctor, they'll be on an inferior plan, et cetera, or they might lose their healthcare altogether if they even have it. So now with the Biden administration attempting also to expand access to so-called Obamacare, although it's got plenty of problems, it actually gives workers that extra ability to change jobs easier, especially if they're getting their insurance under Obamacare. So when you add these extra fiscal policies, the expansion of Obamacare again, these are responses to the disruptive organizing and strikes and wildcats that have been happening throughout the labor force in the last year. We're not seeing as many wildcats right now, but we are seeing more strike threats. And that's something that I write about in my chapter of my new edited book.
And I want to add that, you know, UC San Francisco did a study this year in January, and they said the job where someone is most likely to die of COVID is being a line cook. And so some industries people aren't going back into as we, you know, start to pull a little bit out of the pandemic are things like hospitality, including, you know, restaurants and food preparation. But overall, there are 8 million fewer jobs than there were before the COVID crisis. So as Robert said, people are voting with their feet. And let me just give you some really stark examples. So early in April of this year, Delta Airlines canceled 100 flights. And the reason they gave is was due to a lack of staff. McDonald's right now is still paying people a $50 bonus merely to come in and do an interview. They have so few people doing interviews. There's cases, you know, these stories are all over the bourgeois media about cafes begging their customers to come in and serve coffee. You know, robotics, there's a cafe in Florida that started to use a robot to serve, to deliver food to customers. So there is just this major shortage because there's, you know, the workforce has declined. And that brings up a really important statistic. And, you know, we could look at all these numbers and sometimes they're deceiving. The basic unemployment rate is deceiving if 8 million fewer people are working than they were before the pandemic. One really important number is called the labor participation rate. And right now it's at 61.7%. It just ticked up a little. During the bottom of the trough of the pandemic, it was 60.2%, which is pretty low. The lowest it's ever been since recorded history, which is the post-World War II period, was in 1954. It was 58.1%. So a lot of people are just not working. And this means they're not looking for work. The labor participation means that that huge percentage, the 38.3% of people are just not trying to find jobs. And that's people age 16 and above. So that means we're kind of in this period where the bosses are going to get desperate to get people back to work. And as Robert said, you know, it's bringing up the minimum wage. And I think that's a crucial factor that we need to see because, you know, there's been demands for things like $15 an hour minimum wage. That already is still kind of a poverty wage. And the bar is getting set higher and higher. And I think as the working class sees its strength, it needs to push it even further because I think it is a position historically where the working class truly does have this power because of the restricted labor markets. It means workers can vote with their feet and also hopefully collectively organize and push the wages and conditions even further. Because I think this is one rare occasion where the working class has advantage over the ruling class.
And if I could just add one other factor to that, to what you're saying, Gifford, is that community college enrollment has really nosedived all over the country. All over California, for example, you have as high as a 50% decline in enrollment in community colleges. Now, why is this an indicator of labor force participation and resistance to low-paying jobs? The reason is when the economy is tanking, community college enrollments go way up. People can't find decent work at a decent pay, so they go back to school. They get a Pell Grant. In California, if your income's low enough, you get a waiver of your tuition and fees. That's not happening now. And many people are avoiding going to community colleges. And so this should tell us that workers have a lot of choices out there. And when you have a choice, you can pit employers against each other. And so I think this screaming and hysterics from politicians is really that they're getting a lot of pressure from their donors, from interest groups in the corporate sector who are saying, look, you guys are making it too easy for people to find better work. And you've been cracking down on immigration. So we just, you know, we're looking at a tightening of the labor force, and that means wages are going to go up. So people go back to school when there's not enough choice for good work and good pay. And I think that's also a major indicator that a lot of people aren't talking about. You know, you remember at the beginning of the year, the Democrats had made a big promise that they were going to raise the minimum wage. They allowed a single senator without any accountability, without any threats or punishment to block a meager $15 minimum wage from going through. Now, $15 an hour is already too low. That was a demand almost a decade ago, right? And so this is an illustration of how workers are raising the minimum wage on their own by striking with their feet, by starting to self-organize. You know, I'm kind of critical of the McDonald's walkouts. I think it's a little bit of a PR stunt, But nonetheless, it's giving people an idea that they can actually act in the workplace. And I think that this self-activity of workers is what's raising the minimum wage. And the Democrats are scrambling to keep up with what I think are hollow promises to the labor movement.
Yeah, I mean, just to that point, it's amazing. $15 an hour is still like the demand to be attained when it was like you said, this was something that people were raising up, you know, 10 years ago, literally, as this, you know, back then it was still a poverty wage, and now it's like a joke. But yeah, just moving forward, Biden has stated that he, quote, may punish those who decline work. And of course, there's been other examples of people calling for restrictions or punish workers who, quote, you know, don't work. I'm just curious your thoughts on the rise of this rhetoric and people kind of inching towards that direction as a way to push people back to work.
You know, I think it might backfire. And that's because for all the reasons we've just laid out is I think people are getting a pretty good sense of, you know, the direction the economy's in, and they know their comfort, and they know that people are getting by. Not everyone, granted, you know, we drive on the freeways. I live in the Bay Area. You see under the freeway underpasses just people living in tent cities and living in pretty much squalor. But the people who are in the employable condition know that this is bullshit. And I think by not being intimidated by it, they're kind of calling bullshit. And I think, the more the rhetoric ramps up, I think the angrier people will get. And I'm hoping that will catalyze more forms of resistance and more people seeing that they really need to take collective action to fight back.
I think one of the ways that we'll probably see retaliation is indirect. I think we'll probably start seeing at the end of the year, I imagine the Federal Reserve start warning about having to increase interest rates. Now, what is that actually going to mean if it happens? Right now, they're saying we're not touching interest rates. We're going to keep them low. But let's not forget what happened in the 1970s. After the tumultuous 60s, wildcat strikes were widespread in the 1970s. Public employees were striking all over the country from the South to California. And we saw the passage of various state collective bargaining laws that essentially institutionalized these self-organized unions in the public sector. Well, at the end of the 1970s, we got that double whopper recession. Interest rates shot up while wages were going up, right? And the intention there was to dry up credit so that it was a strategy for essentially punishing companies that settled with their workers and allowed them to raise wages because they would have to pass that along to customers and higher costs. So Paul Volcker, the head of the Fed, wanted to also undermine President Carter's fiscal spending policies. So he jacked up interest rates almost 20%. And that essentially turned into a several-year-long recession that crashed the Carter administration's reelection hopes. Now, what does this mean in class terms? When wages start to rise, the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates for that exact reason, because they will try to dry up credit that will force employers to reverse course and start to attack wages and start to implement layoffs and automation and outsourcing and so forth. So if we start to see interest rates rise, that's going to be the Democrats' signal that they're not going to allow workers to continue to have this leverage in the labor force. How we rock. Halos, Hoop Troop Rockers, All City All Night. All right, check it, yeah, oh. Surprise, you wonder where I've been. I've been creeping in dirty alleys and back streets while you were sleeping. It's all for you, it's really all for you. Still an everyday struggle for me to do my do, It's time to get out of the house and gather the whole crew, we come by the thousand. Saints flying all city now, I mean, by taking back 25 years now, baby. Yes, way before the stage shows, before we started our own label. Labeled as lowlifes and used to lay low. Staying close on the lookout for plain clothes. Plain to see that we had no say-so as soon as I set foot in that courtroom. Case closed. Those fucking a-holes call us cowards, but that gave power to brave souls. Rockin' halos. Back to the back, how we rock halos.
No, there's no forgiveness for our sins. Since we don't play along and hold it in. When you roll with angels on your side, you don't worry about the evil eyes. You do what you intend. Can't abide by the rules of some bitter old men. The root of all evil proven time and time again. Passed down generations proud of their ignorance. You least likely to succeed, most likely to go in. But they don't see past the features of their skin. They've been told change is blowing in the wind. I've been up on my mission to offend. With my hat to the back, B-boy stands in a grin.
Being a saint, but I can't help but to see it that way. With your hat to the back, headphones on, those fools don't know what goes on.
First day in high school, I knew nobody would get that. I was the freshest in my Def Jam mesh hat. And later on, I almost got my ass kicked, cause I used to rock a Public Enemy t-shirt.
Cause if you stood out,
they would stand on you, demand from you
that your flame would be put out.
Ha, but we keep on shining.
Hat to the back, how we keep on styling.
So during the pandemic, as you both have stated, we saw a variety of workplace struggles and actions break out. Like you were saying, there was a wave of wildcat strikes. This has been documented pretty heavily on sites like Payday. There's also been attempts to unionize at different places, like for instance, Amazon. We just saw a pretty well-publicized drive there that was not successful. I'm just curious your thoughts on resistance on the shop floor during the pandemic and what this says about the state of things.
I think the Messimer, Alabama effort at unionizing Amazon workers is very troubling in several different ways. First of all, it's a demonstration of some of the most outdated and ineffective unionization strategies that have essentially tanked the working class for the last 40 years. We've seen essentially the working class get beaten over and over again with these kinds of tactics. Essentially, a bureaucratic top-down union shows up, sends in a few paid organizers, and then immediately rushes to file for a representational election, and immediately discovers that they don't even know how many workers work in the plant, in the warehouse. With the rest of the story has already been well documented, but it runs in direct, vivid contrast to organizing that's been happening throughout Amazon, not just in the United States, New York, Chicago, Minnesota, but also in numerous countries around the world where Amazon workers have been self-organizing. They've been picking their fights, identifying their issues, organizing quietly, underground, and then carrying out marches on the boss, demonstrating their effectiveness by winning small victories and then escalating. And they've been coordinating with other Amazon workers, both inside and outside of formal unions in Italy and Spain and Germany, and several other countries, where they've been much more effective at organizing from the bottom up. And so while 60,000 news articles were reportedly written about Bessemer, Alabama's failed effort, almost nothing is being written about these workers who are actually taking on Amazon and actually winning. And I think that is one of the outcomes of that wave of wildcat strikes that we were talking about earlier. that workers are starting to recognize that they do have power over work in the workplace. And even though some of the victories have been quite small, I think they're laying the groundwork for a kind of rejuvenation of a labor movement from below.
And I would add to that, I think Robert's completely dead on. I think the importance has to be in scope. Amazon is rising. I don't know if it's past Walmart to be the U.S.'s biggest company yet, but it'll happen inevitably. But you can't organize against a major global player at just one site. And that was the weakness. It has to be an industrial form of organizing. And Amazon has, you know, side-by-side fulfillment centers. You strike one, there's one down the road. They'll just ship all the goods movement to that one. That was a big mistake. And they just tried to organize very poorly at one site. And it was the, you know, the retail, wholesale, and department store union, which is a subsidiary of one of the worst unions in the U.S., which is the UFCW. And not to pick on the unions but this union is a particularly sellout union. In 1985 and 1986, they led the rank and file to defeat in Austin, Minnesota at a Hormel. It's called Hormel P9, a meatpacking plant. The union, the international, overrode the local, and they lost the strike. Some of the same people got involved in the 2003-2004 Southern California grocery strike, when 77,000 workers went out on strike. I actually went to Southern California, met some of the strikers, and they said, like, the union is running this like they want to lose. And you see the same thing in Bessemer, Alabama. The union didn't have a strategy. It was a top-down, staff-driven thing. The rank and file wasn't even involved, so the legacy it leaves isn't very much. Yet, as Robert mentioned, in Europe, they have cross-border meetings, and they coordinate. There's particularly interesting things happen between Polish Amazon workers and German Amazon workers because the bosses play them off of each other, and they defeat that by uniting and having meetings together and strategizing across that border. So I think it's going to take a lot more than the kind of media savvy campaign they tried in Alabama. I think it's going to be really have to come from the shop floor and be a bottom up effort. And I would say, as a criticism of that whole Amazon effort, is there are moves afoot. There are Amazon workers in North America trying to coordinate, as Robert said, kind of beneath the surface and form the connections to strengthen it before they do these kind of foolish going public before they even have built any strength among the workforce. So, you know, I think it's a cautionary tale of what not to do in organizing.
Yeah. And I think also to follow up what you're saying, Gifford, if you want to know more about what we're talking about, I would encourage you to take a look at some of the chapters of a book called Cost of Free Shipping, Amazon in the Global Economy by Jake Wilson and Ellen Reese that came out from Pluto last year. And there's a few chapters by some of these worker organizers in the book. And some of these folks actually showed up to one of the webinars that I coordinated, Pluto Press webinars called How We Organize. And it was an extraordinary international conversation. And you can find it on YouTube, How We Organize Pluto Press. And it was an extraordinary exchange of thinking and planning and strategies and tactics from Amazon workers across four countries. And I think that that's where we need to be looking. What was tried in Bessemer is a tried and true strategy of failure.
Would there be a way, in theory, for workers to use aspects of the current situation to their advantage? I think we've already kind of, you know, brought up this concept, but I'm curious, you know, your further thoughts on it. We've already seen strikes like groups like already mentioned, Fight for 15, over the past week demanding higher wages. But of course, in some areas, some fast food places are already offering wages, you know, far beyond $15. So I'm curious, in your mind, if workers were going to take action in this situation, what would some of those things potentially look like?
I think the focus needs to be on identifying where we have the most power, where even a small number of well-organized workers strategically located at what Manny Ness and Jake Wilson called choke points can have the most effective impact. You know, it's impressive that there are fast food workers that are walking out. The problem is that they're walking out. They're not actually shutting down the stores in many cases. They're going into the streets and having media savvy protests. And I think that what we saw early on in the early months of the pandemic was these workers that found that reproductive labor sectors of the capitalist economy can actually serve as choke points. In other words, when half the population is sheltering in place and there's supermarkets and delivery services that are facing strikes, I think we found a new choke point. And that choke point is where we need to be putting our effort. I think that that wave of wildcat strikes demonstrated that second element of what I was talking about at the beginning. First, that reproductive labor is crucial to capitalist production. And second, that reproductive labor can actually serve as the choke point. We've just got to be strategic about it. And that's where we'll find some continuing outcomes that really tip the balance in the favor of workers.
And this is not necessarily addressing your question, but I do look to sectors that were kind of facing the most intense conditions under the pandemic. And I would say healthcare is a place to keep looking at. Here in California, the nurses, particularly in one of the better unions in the country, the umbrella for the national is the National Nurses United here in California. It's the California Nurses Association. With all its limitations, it has a mobilized rank and file. And a lot of the nurses, realizing they were in harm's way, some of the healthcare institutions like hospitals threw out, a little bit of perks like, a little bit of hazard pay. And the nurses said no. They said, what we want is we don't want tokens. We don't want gestures. We want it to be safe for the patients and for us. And there were countless, not documented in the press, but walkouts throughout the pandemic led by nurses, led by the rank and file, making that demand I just said, saying, we don't want to work for anyone, including ourselves and the patients, unless you make it safe. And I think that's a really powerful statement, is they know what's up. They know issues that are really important, like patient to healthcare provider ratios. And there's actually amazing, here in California, the nurses actually won something. It's called Title 22, where it's locked in. It's the lowest patient to nurse ratio in the country. And during the pandemic, the nurses fought to defend that. In California, the state said they could apply for a waiver. And nurses agitated in almost every healthcare facility across California. Management backed down on getting the waiver, which would have allowed more nurses to have to handle more patients. So I think that's one sector to be really to look for in the future as kind of a beacon for struggle, because I think they've been kicking ass. I think they're going to continue to kick ass. I live in San Francisco, here in San Francisco yesterday, at a hospital that just got organized, and it was first organized ever. It's a hospital that's existed for 100 years. It's the Chinese Hospital in Chinatown. They got their first contract in August of 2019. They did their first strike yesterday. It was just a one-day strike, but they had 90% participation. 90% of the workforce didn't cross the picket line. A couple scabs crossed the picket line. Some of my friends were there. Nurses got on their phones and texted to other hospitals, knowing some of the nurses worked at multiple hospitals. The nurses at the other hospitals say, we remember who struck before, or who scabbed before. We'll never forget these people who scabbed on our strike. I think that's kind of an indication of a rising level of class consciousness. People know what's up. They know what the struggle's about, and they're organizing and they're communicating. So I'm very inspired by all these developments.
I would also add, Gifford, you've done a lot of work on supply chains. And you mentioned it a little while ago also that the global supply chain was severely disrupted in the early months of the pandemic. And we're still seeing a disruption. It's taking months for goods to be shipped around the world. The mails are delayed all over the world. And so I think if workers want to be effective in their organizing, they really need to identify where their workplace is in the global supply chain and identify workers along that supply chain that they can cooperate with. And just to give you an example, I was reading a story yesterday about how truckers are being recruited with a voracious appetite. There's just a shortage of truckers. And this is a major turnaround. You know, just a few years ago, there were a series of wildcat trucker strikes along the West Coast because these workers were essentially contract gig workers who weren't being paid for their idle time, who were essentially making minimum wage. You know, the result of deregulating the trucking sector, just the decimation of unionized truckers. And so now there's a shortage of truckers. And before, just a few years ago, they found it very difficult to organize truckers. Now it should be an effective choke point that those who are organizing that sector to be thinking about how does trucking connect to other parts of the economy. And I know, Gifford, you've been working on this with workers in the train sector and other parts of the transportation sector. And this is the kind of strategic thinking that needs to go in to organizing to take advantage of where we are right now.
Yeah, and just to add, you know, recently I was at a meeting, by Zoom, and it was mostly railroaders, and it was including some maritime workers, and talking about, like what you just said, Robert, is it's multimodal. We live with a world system of production that's spread across the planet, and the only way workers will have power when they're so spread thin is by creating bonds of unity. And just it begins with dialogue and discussing, you know, strategies of how they could work together. And I think that's a crucial point. The books you mentioned have amazing stories internationally of workers coordinating their efforts, because, you know, if some good is produced in China, it doesn't mean all the things are made in China. If it's a garment, the cotton could have been grown in Senegal and Africa, and it goes on ships and it's brought by trucks and trains across the world. And we have to kind of broaden our minds and start thinking in those terms, especially workers in those sectors. And the linkages they can make among themselves, I think, is what's going to, you know, have a great impact on class struggle going forward.
It's such an interesting time where it seems like the loudest voices about all this stuff are obviously on the right, you know, calling for reopening and talking about, you know, my freedom to go and get a haircut and all that stuff. Whereas, you know, obviously you have all this stuff that's building from below, which of course is not represented in the corporate media. I'm just curious if that dynamic at all, if you're seeing that play out.
That's a good question. You know, I think also what's happening is, you know, we're going through a period of what the Italians used to call in the 70s in their struggles, class recomposition. And, you know, it's a good question. I think, you know, to get your hair cut, there might not be a worker who's willing to do it. In where I live, in my neighborhood, I see a lot of those shops closing or having closed. And it's an important question. I see that this huge reshuffling, a lot of the kind of more service industries are closing because there's just people not willing to provide it for all the reasons we detailed before. But I think a lot of kind of industries are going to shift or disappear. And I'm not really answering your question, but I think we're going through this amazing period of transformation. And I don't think we're even at the beginning of it yet. I think we're still going through this process where we're going to see a lot of things, close, and, you know, everything retail is going to be really transformed by things like delivery and the app ability to push an app on your phone and get something delivered within the day is just insane. So, I see that, you know, the demands to get your hair cut because you want to open up is just, you know, I think the culture wars have turned being safe into kind of a sign of being a Democrat, and being carefree as being a sign of Republican. And I think it's ridiculous. And, but I think it's regional. I think it's different in different parts of the country. It's not a really sufficient answer, but I think, you know, we're seeing this great period of flux and we're right in the midst of it.
You know, if I could reflect on my own experience as an educator. I teach currently at two institutions, part-time at two institutions in the Bay Area. And both of the administrations have done student surveys in the last couple of months. And what's extraordinary about it is that, and faculty surveys, and what's extraordinary about the results is I kind of scratch my head a little bit, because we all want to be back in the classroom. Overwhelmingly, students say they don't like learning online, but overwhelmingly say they don't want to go back into the classroom yet. Same thing with the faculty. We all want to go back and see our students in person and connect in a personal way. Learning is just not the same on Zoom and Canvas and these learning management systems. And there's also a lot of dangers of moving it all online. very suddenly a little over a year ago. But at the same time, we're not ready to put each other at risk. And I think that that's a form of class solidarity, that we're starting to see that we have this commonality. And the commonality is that we can't be forced to work when we're putting ourselves and others that we care about and that we work with lives at danger. And I think that that's a pretty powerful sign.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at IGD_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show.
We've both in the past talked about automation, and you were bringing up the idea of delivery services becoming more part of people's everyday lives. What do you think the lasting impact of the pandemic will be just on capitalist production in general? Like, are we seeing a shift more towards automation? Has this accelerated those forces, or are we seeing like other things develop that maybe before we weren't even really thinking about?
I'm reading this really fascinating book right now called Breaking Things at Work by Gavin Mueller. And one of the things that really stands out, and I didn't know the aftermath of this story about Flippy the robot that they started introducing into fast food restaurants. A lot of people didn't know this either, that Flippy lasted a single day. This robot was essentially taken off the assembly line at the fast food restaurant because the workers essentially were going too slow. And whether it was intentional or not, they essentially sabotaged the automation. Gavin Mueller is essentially building upon work that was done several decades ago by David Noble, who's passed away a few years back, who did incredible work on automation. And I think we have a misunderstanding that robots are going to take our jobs, or that robots are going to do everything for us and we're going to live a life of comfort. I think it's somewhere in between. What we're looking at is a changing division of labor. As class struggle accelerates, employers respond by introducing new technologies, and that is what the Italians call decomposing the working class. It breaks us up and reorganizes us in a different way. We lose control over our work. But it doesn't mean that work goes away. Work shifts somewhere else. New work is created in ways that we hadn't perceived before. And then we end up with this kind of paradox where a lot of people are working way too much and a lot of people have no access to employment. Really, what they need is income. but they don't even have access to employment. So we have this contradiction building. And I don't think that robots are going to steal our jobs, but I do think that these new technologies are going to be introduced as a way to impose discipline and extract more productivity and more profits from workers. We're already seeing this in higher education. Going online has been an incredible speed up for educators while decimating the quality of education.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I think we could say that machines displacing humans is kind of the history of capitalism. And, you know, at the beginning of capitalism, people had the traditions of crafts, and you know, the early forms of industry were, you know, we went through periods, you know, we called some of the advances or the attempts to kind of create more time and control with things like Taylorism, and then we had Fordism. And so I think this is just the history of capitalism. But I think as long as capitalists can exploit people and externalize the costs onto them, they'll do that as much as they can. So I'm kind of in complete agreement with Robert. I think it's a mixed thing. I think automation will exist where it can, but I think if, you know, the capitalists could have exploit people just based on, you know, extending the amount of time they work, you know, the relative surplus value, and extract more or even extract more in less time, I think capitalists do that too. And I don't think there's one single trajectory, but I think it's just a pure system of exploitation, and capitalists do whatever they can get away with. And so, yeah, I think my position on automation is they do it when they can, but it's also expensive. And it also takes workers to create the machines and program the software. And you know, it becomes obsolete, and there's competition where there are new machines and things like that. So I think the history of capitalism is very complex. And I think the main takeaway I take is that just, it's just the process of capitalism further disempowers workers and takes them further away from the process of reproducing their own lives. And I think that's what we should focus our resistance on.
Yeah. So, you know, I see a lot of commonalities across the labor force of how technology is being introduced. For example, we've read a lot about how Amazon workers are monitored through AI. Robots have been introduced on the warehouse floor, moving the carts around. The workers are tracked. Every motion is tracked. Essentially, the digital collection of information is Taylor's digital stopwatch. Well, the same thing is happening in all other parts of the labor force. In higher education, for example, much of my work is done on how academic labor is being sped up and disciplined by the use of these new digital technologies. And in some ways, what professors and other academic laborers are facing is really not that far away from what Amazon workers and gig workers are facing. There's a kind of ubiquitous use of technology to monitor and break down every aspect of the work that we do and to try to snap off pieces of it and outsource it or automate it. For example, I'm constantly inundated every day with spam email from various app companies that are trying to sell their automatic grading apps that can be plugged into this portal that's called Canvas, that is the second largest commonly used online tool for teaching online. And I'm essentially being enticed to ask the university to make this app accessible so that I don't have to grade anymore. But what we don't realize is that every moment that we're using the online portal, data is being generated. Where we go, how long we stay, how much time we spend. And then that information is a mountain of information, but that information is then used to evaluate and assess the productivity of our labor. And also it's information that can be passed along to potential employers that will be used to evaluate and track the quality of the labor of our students. It's kind of a lifetime, if you will, labor quality record. That's a massive amplification of tracking of workers that HR departments already use. So when we think about these technologies that are being introduced, they're being tried out in different parts of the labor force, you know, with app workers, gig workers, Amazon, but they're also being introduced even among skilled workers. Doctors and nurses face this. Even lawyers are seeing the introduction of these kinds of technologies. So I think rather than actually think of it as robots are going to take our jobs, it's more that robots are going to be used to discipline and extract more labor from workers. And we have to be conscious of that. We have to respond to that in our organizing.
Thank you so much for joining us. Is there any other thoughts that you have in closing, or if you have something you want to plug, Robert, I know that you have a new book, and Gifford, if there's anything else that you want to talk about or kind of give a nod to?
Yeah, I want to just plug stuff. So Robert, go first.
Yeah. So on June 7th is the first of a series of monthly book club meetings that I'll be launching with Strike Maps UK, an incredible project in the UK that's tracking strikes there. We're partnering with Pluto Press, and every month you get a chapter of my book and you get to meet the author of that chapter. And so you can sign up on FB, or go to Strike Maps UK. And then also Gifford and I are going to be doing something together, later in June. With the Marxist Education Project. We'll be doing a mini workers' inquiry together. So I hope that folks can join us for that.
And I just like to kind of make a broader statement. You know, I think a big deal as far as strikes and class struggle in the United States was back in 2018 with the West Virginia teachers. And it wasn't just teachers, excuse me, it was the educators, and it wasn't just the educators. Whole communities rose up because just the conditions have gotten so bad. And it just set off a wave of strikes. You know, the pandemic put an end to it because students weren't in the classroom, but, you know, it went from West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Georgia, Arizona, Colorado, North Carolina, Tennessee, California, two big cities, the second biggest city in the country. Los Angeles had a big educator strike.
And Puerto Rico,
Oakland, you know, and it just continues. I mean, it continued until the pandemic, but I think I would look to sectors like education and healthcare, as Robert said before, kind of the reproductive industries. And I think people are fighting back, and I think the pandemic put it on pause. I think it's coming back. I think we should look to that again, and I think it's going to come back stronger when the pandemic finally fades away.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.